Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us for an evening of discussion, and there will be questions and answers on a very, very important topic, one that is not necessarily pressing more now today than in days of yore, but one that has always been front and center for the Jewish people. Honesty, integrity, ultimately the dignity of our people in the eyes of the world, Kiddush Hashem, God forbid not the opposite, Chilul Hashem. We have with us this evening two fantastic individuals, two true experts in their fields and in the convergence of the legal and halachic aspects of the topic at hand. Rabbi Yitzchak Grossman is a scholar par excellence. I had the pleasure of hearing a shiur, of reading a few articles, and of recognizing that he is truly a young, budding star, if you will, in the Jewish halachic scene, in teaching, in publishing, and as Emir Tzashem will see tonight, public lecturing as well. He's a Talmud of Rav David Soloveitchik, of Rav Meir Stern in Passaic, and of course then also in Bis Medrash Gavoa, in Lakewood. I want to thank the Beis Avad in Yonei Mishpat, the Beis Avad Business Halacha Center, and Rabbi Shmuel Wilhelm for introducing me personally to Rav Yitzchak Grossman and for being tremendous enablers of this evening's event. We have with us Mr. Ben Brafman, who is one of the most prominent criminal attorneys in the country today. His client list includes Michael Jackson, I suppose of blessed memory, Plaxico Burress, Sean, Puff Daddy Combs, Sammy the Bull, Gravano, and also Dominic Strauss Kahn, Rabbi Menachem Eulis, also known as the Jewish Indiana Jones, if you will, Attorney Sanford Rubinstein, Charles Kushner. Ben Brafman is a personal friend, and that's a point of pride for myself and my family. I'm proud to also have known and treasured a friendship with his parents, Aleha Mashalom, who have a great number of wonderful children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren of whom they are very, very proud. We are proud to have Ben and Linda Brafman as members of our shul. And in his practice, he has made numerous efforts on individual and on public levels, lifting up the awareness of our community as he has lifted the awareness of individuals to the importance of doing our work and living our lives in accordance with the law of the land and in the effort of truly serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu with honor and in a certain sense with grace in the eyes of God and in the eyes of man. Three times a day, we say, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvakos. We invoke the holiness of the Almighty. We also pledge that we are going to cause such holiness. Nekadesh es Shimcha ba'olam. And the means of doing so is certainly not only by sacrificing our very lives if it becomes, God forbid, necessary to do so. That's not what our pledge of Nekadesh es Shimcha ba'olam is all about. Gemara tells us, as an example, how the great Shimon ben Shetach created the tremendous Kiddush Hashem. He once purchased a donkey, which is comparable today to going out and buying, a Chevy, a Toyota. And Around the neck of the donkey, there just happened to have been a little pouch and a precious gem, a gemstone. Somewhere on the pouch or in the saddle pack, somewhere there was this precious gem which the Arab had overlooked, and it was, along with the donkey, now in Shimon ben Shetach's possession. And he, of course, immediately returned the gem to its owner. Though those who might have worked for Shimon ben Shetach didn't appreciate it. And this Gentile, who now received this gemstone back, cried out, "Blessed be the God of the Jews, who renders his people so scrupulous in their dealings with their fellow man." That's what we are committing to, my friends, when we say, "Nekadesh et Shimcha ba'olam." And if you will, the fact that we say it three times, Kadosh, 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 and that we commit to that kind of sanctification of God's name. I am, and it's not a secret, I am of the Nusach Sfard persuasion. I still miss every Shabbos morning, Kesa Yitnu Lucha Hashem Elokeinu Malachim Hamayni Mala. There's a crown, there's a keser, with which the Almighty is crowned, but not only by the angels, not only with the Malachim Kvutse Mala, Imanshe Yisrael, together with the Jewish people, Kvutse Mata. That crown is placed, so to speak, upon the Almighty by virtue of what we do. And then the next sentence is, Yachad Kulam Kedusha L'cha Yishaleshu. We're going to impart sanctity and make it real. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Perhaps it means Kadosh in the most public realm where the Gentile world sees us. Kadosh where it's only between and amongst us. And thirdly, Kadosh when it's only myself and my Creator. But that's what we are committing ourselves to. To know and appreciate that. And the parameters, the do's and perhaps especially the don'ts, we've brought together our panelists for this evening. And again, I want to thank Rav Yitzchak Grossman, who will begin with a brief halachic outline of Torah and ethics in the business place. And then we will hear from Mr. Ben Brafman on some of the practical and some of the experiences he has had and the guidance that he will offer. And then, not a rebuttal, but a response by Rabbi Grossman's part. Again, thank you very much, Rabbi Yitzchak Grossman.
I want to begin by thanking Rabbi Teitelbaum for inviting me out here. Thank my friends and colleagues at the Beis Avad, Rabbi Wilhelm, for their graciousness and their help in getting me out here. Great to be here. Thank you all for coming. I want to just begin by reiterating, by underscoring what Rabbi Teitelbaum said. The alpha and omega of any discussion like this is, some people call it the New York Times test, the Washington Post test. Never, ever do anything that you're going to see your name in a front page article in the newspaper. Chilul Hashem is absolutely the worst thing that a Jew can do. Rambam says there are different kinds of sins a person can do. Some of them you have tshuva, some Yom Kippur, some Yisurim, suffering, punishment. Chilul Hashem is the absolute worst. Chilul Hashem, it says in Yeshaya, Im Yechupar Ha'avon Hazeh Lachem Ad Temusun, Chilul Hashem cannot be atoned for until death. Chilul Hashem is something we really, really don't want to do. So certainly avoid making a Chilul Hashem, and even, as per the story of Shimon ben Shetach, make a Kiddush Hashem where possible. That's certainly, again, the alpha and omega. And tonight I want to discuss, though, the basic ideas of Dina Malchus Adina. The non-Jews say, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And in Halacha we say, Dina Malchus Adina, the idea that the law of the land is the law binding upon Jews. The actual parameters of the principle, as it appears in the classic sources, are actually somewhat tricky and somewhat involved. What I want to do tonight instead is discuss a number of different doctrines that appear in the later acronym that argue for paying even much more attention to the law than the classic Din Malchus Adina would have indicated. A number of reasons why, examples how the poskim took the law very seriously and felt that secular law, temporal law, was absolutely binding and mandatory upon Jews. I want to begin with a tshuva, a ruling of the Tzur HaShai, Shlomo Yehuda Tabak, a leading 19th century expert on Choshen Mishpat. There's an old joke about what is chutzpah. Chutzpah is the fellow who murders his parents and then pleads for clemency because he's an orphan. This question to the Tzur HaShai comes pretty close to that. There was a fellow who wanted a government contract. He didn't want to pay market rates for it, so we bribed the relevant officials to give him a no-bid sweetheart deal. Someone else found out about it, went over the corrupt official's head to the other government officials and said, I'll give you a fair price for it. First guy was not happy about being cut out, so we took him to a dintara and said, I was here first. Halacha gives me protections against unfair competition. I want you to withdraw your bid. The Tzur HaShai was not hearing any of this. He said, we don't give protections to people who do corrupt and prohibited things, who sin, who do averis. Why is this an avera? Let me count the ways. He gives a whole slew of reasons why corrupting officials and getting corrupt bids on contracts is usur, is prohibited by biblical law, by all kinds of law, you name it. First of all, he says, corruption per se, shochad, bribery. A Jew is not allowed to take shochad. A non-Jew is not allowed to take shochad. Even though they only have 7 Noachide laws, Shochad is included, he says, based on Ramban and Parshas V'Yishlach recently, that non-Jews are also obligated to have integrity in their judicial systems. If you corrupt a non-Jewish official by bribing him, you are over Lufnei Iver L'Sitein Michshol, you're placing a stumbling block in the path of the blind, you're over an Isser Daraisa for the corruption per se. Second, he says, theft. You're stealing government property. Nothing to do with, this is not simply fraud or embezzlement, this is outright theft. You're obtaining goods or services under false pretenses by officials who have no right to do this in this corrupt way. You are a gazlan, you are stealing, and therefore this is absolutely usur again. This is absolutely prohibited what he's done. Third, he says, and this is an extremely powerful argument, very relevant to us, he says, all the classic discussion about governments, about non-Jews, whatever you might have heard, he says, completely irrelevant in contemporary situations, he says, that was back then where the governments were basically glorified bandits, where they set themselves up and they taxed people for their own self-enrichment, he says. Today, 19th century Europe still, today, he says, governments provide services. The services benefit the entire community, Jews, non-Jews alike. Moreover, he says, if you steal government revenue, they have to raise taxes to get more revenue, he says. You're stealing from your fellow Jews. You're stealing from the community. Government is not some kind of abstract entity. Government is the people. It's government by the people, for the people. He says, you're simply stealing from your fellow Jews, from your friends and neighbors. What you're doing, he says, is absolutely usur, is prohibited on all these grounds, and therefore you certainly have no right to ask for any protections under the rules of fair competition. So this is a very important doctrine, not necessarily accepted by everyone, but the idea, you can't just look at the government as some kind of, even corporations today, all corporations have Jewish shareholders. Rav Tabak insists that even though there might only be a minority of Jewish citizens, he says, so what? Minority of Jews too. So he says, cheating the government, he says, even same thing would seem to apply to corporations, cheating corporations, he says, you can't just look at them as some kind of abstract entity of corporations, you're cheating everyone, you're cheating the community, you're cheating your friends, your neighbors. That is simply theft, that's usur, and he doesn't want any of it. That is one doctrine why today we're not simply dealing with Din Malchus Adina as some kind of abstract principle. It's out and out theft. You're stealing from everyone, from non-Jew, from Jew alike, and it is absolutely prohibited. Second related point is that the governments that are being discussed in classic sources were autocracies. There wasn't much in the way of democracy, maybe in ancient Greece. Once you move beyond Greece, even then, democracy wasn't exactly what we would recognize as democracy, certainly not in the Dark Ages, in the medieval period, Talmudic period. They were not dealing with democracies. They were dealing with strongmen, again, warlords, kings, dictators, tyrants, and so on. And even then we find the Talmud said, Din Malchus Adina, even then we find the Talmud says that everything they say is binding. He says, certainly today, the poskim say, certainly today we're dealing with democracies, we're dealing with government, again, by the people, for the people. Even back then in Talmudic times, one of the main theories for why the Talmud felt that we need to listen to secular law is the Rashbam. The Rashbam famously explains that the people, there's a kind of consent to the governed. The modern notion of the legitimacy of the government is based on the consent to the governed. That's still the theory in vogue today, that the people, the power is sovereign in the people, it devolves to their representatives. But even then, where they didn't have any real elections, they were simply dictators and tyrants, even then the people somehow tacitly accept whoever is de facto the government. They accept him as their government. Certainly today, the post can say, certainly today we have elected governments. The governments are chosen by the people. That's even more powerful than Dina Malchusa. They simply are the mouthpieces of the people themselves. You're dealing with the people, not with some kind of abstract government who have certain limited privileges. You're dealing with the sovereign people themselves and their property and their communal assets. Certainly what they say is binding. With their assets are the people's assets. You certainly can't cheat them. You certainly can't defy them. That's a doctrine that's adopted by numerous achronim today, that the governments today are legitimate, even much more so than in the time of Chazal, because of the notion of democratic control. The truth is, this discussion of democracy is not a new one. We don't really find that much about it in Talmudic sources, but going back already to medieval sources, the Rishonim, we find a fair amount of discussion of what we would recognize as democracy. Obviously, they didn't have national sovereignty at that point. What they did have was local sovereignty. The local Jewish communities in the medieval period controlled their own affairs. They regulated themselves, they policed themselves, they collected taxes and forwarded it to the national government or whoever was collecting it from them. So we actually have an extensive literature in the Rishonim and Ashkenaz in particular discussing the notion of democracy, voting, how voting is done, who should vote, how the voting should be, what are the rights of the minority, all the same questions we deal with today. But how to express the will of a people when you don't have absolute unanimity? These are all discussed by the Rishonim, the Zayin Tuvei Ha'er, the seven councilmen or freeholders of the city. These are ancient institutions. Halacha has a very strong tradition of democracy, again, going back to the medieval period. And many poskim today rule, therefore, that the legitimacy of modern governments is rooted in this, again, in the notion of democracy. It's at least equal to and actually much more powerful than the notion of Dina Malchusa, Dina and the Gemara, the idea that governments today represent the people, are chosen by the people, act in the best interest of the people, ideally at least, hopefully. And this is another doctrine we find in the contemporary Achronim for why a Jew needs to respect decisions taken by his elected government. A third, and again related doctrine we find in many of the poskim, is the idea that given that we don't police our own affairs, we don't have our own legislatures outside Israel, certainly. We simply don't have our own government. So it has to be. There's simply no other way to run society. There has to be somebody in charge. There has to be somebody whose laws and authority are binding. If it's not us, unfortunately, we don't have our own sovereignty, it has to be the local government. There's simply no other way to do things. Rav Henkin, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, the grand old man of American halacha, he articulates this very forcefully at length. He was writing in the context of rent stabilization laws. I know we have that back in New York City. I'm not sure what happens outside New York City, but some jurisdictions have all kinds of laws. The government steps in, regulates how much you can charge, you know, how much a landlord can raise his rates, and questions like that. Can't evict as long as he's paying rent, and so on. And this is a very vigorous discussion going back about a century in the poskim, how halacha should relate to such legislation. Rav Henkin has a full-throated, unequivocal support of these laws, and he gives a very programmatic and comprehensive defense of the binding authority of American law, federal, state, whatever it is, law. He says that we don't have our own communities, we can't pass our own legislation, we have no ability to regulate our own affairs. So common sense says, he says, we have to say that the laws of the authorities, whoever they are, those laws are binding on us. Someone has to make laws, you can't have anarchy, he says. So of course, we follow their laws, and their laws are absolutely binding upon us. This actually comes up in a number of interesting tshuvas also on the topic of intellectual property, copyrights, patents. Poskim have struggled mightily for about 150 years trying to construct some kind of halachic doctrine of intellectual property of all the various branches, copyright mostly, a little bit of patent. So there's a remarkable tshuva of Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson, a great Galician posek from the 19th century. In one of the most remarkable acts of Gordian knot cutting in halacha, he simply declares it into existence. He says, well, secular law has a notion of intellectual property. He says, how can the Torah not have an equivalent law? He just makes a wholesale, he snaps his fingers, a wholesale importation of secular law into halacha on the ground, on basically two principles. It's common sense, he says, the notion that a creator should have the right to his creation, and it's recognized by secular law. So halacha has the same thing, just like that. Not everyone agrees to that, but some do. There's a similar tshuva in the Sefer Hazoros Tshuva, another 19th century work. He says again, Din Malchus Adina, with all the technical rules and caveats, when it applies, when it doesn't apply, he says, I'll tell you one thing, he says. You know when it definitely does apply, he says, when there's something that even halacha, even Torah recognizes as being a good idea, as being morally correct, not everything that's moral is automatically legislated by halacha. But where something is clearly recognized by Das Torah, by common sense, by intuition in accord with the Torah, as being proper, he says, and then the secular law codifies it into law, then of course halacha recognizes that, he says. It's right in and of itself, and the law accepts it as law, so of course such a law is binding upon Jews. And intellectual property is a great example, he says. Common sense, he says, tells you that the creator of an intellectual work ought to have the right to control distribution and or benefit and profit from it, he says. So it stands to reason, he says, it should go without saying that we recognize such a law if the law grants the creator right to benefit from his creation. Certainly halacha should do the same thing. Mention another interesting tshuva in this context. This is by the great Rabbi Leo Kalatskin, an always interesting Polish-Russian posek from around World War I era. Sometimes you see a question, you wonder, why is this even a question? Why would they even ask him this? I don't know. He still managed to have 3 pages on this. But the question was, this was in 1893. There was a cholera epidemic going on. I think, it was, according to Wikipedia, it would have been the fifth major wave of cholera epidemics and pandemics of the 19th century. So the governments were desperately trying to introduce all kinds of sanitary regulations. So they had a law. You can't sell meat. They didn't have refrigeration. You can't sell meat more than a certain number of days after the slaughter. This was very difficult for the kosher butchers right around Rosh Hashanah. It was very tight, and it was hard to do. So they asked him, do we really have to follow this law? Can we just like forget about it, flout the law, and sell meat that's maybe a little spoiled? It won't be too bad, hopefully. So kind of like you'd think it was a no-brainer, and he answers that. He answers, of course not, absolutely not. You cannot endanger the lives of your customers simply because you think it would be more profitable for you to do so. It might be bad business practice, too, in the long run, but he says, certainly, but in halacha, it's prohibited, too. Mainly because it's dangerous, he says, you can't do it. But in the course of his tshuva, he says, and also, it's against the law. The law says you can't do it, so you can't do it. And that's it, he says. Again, the law makes sense. It's clearly a sensible law. We can't regulate our own affairs. The government does. The government passes laws that make sense, that are eminently sensible and for the good of the community. So, of course, the law is binding. It's actually quite ironic. I was looking into this a little bit. We know today, cholera is actually not transmitted through tainted meat. Rav Kalatskin makes a whole point of saying we follow, in halacha, we follow the opinions of the best opinions of medical science, and medical science, he believed at least, believed that cholera was transmitted through tainted meat. It actually isn't. It's transmitted through tainted water, or possibly shellfish. I don't think any real epidemics are transmitted through tainted meat. You can get E. coli, and maybe in certain get mad cow disease, but most of the horrific pandemics of the 19th century had to do with water or were airborne. So it's actually funny that the main concern he had, the meat was dangerous. It actually wasn't all that dangerous. But the point stands, A, halacha requires you not to take an act of reckless self-endangerment, even on your own cheshbon, certainly not to endanger someone else because you want to make a profit. And also, he says, follow the law. If the law is meant to protect society, if the law is meant to keep people healthy and safe and to regulate society in a sensible and rational way, then of course you have no business flouting such a law, and of course you have to follow the law. There's one last doctrine which is very important. This applies primarily in areas of contract in the broadest sense, any agreement between two people, landlord-tenant, employer-employee, partners, and so on. Many poskim have argued, again, over the last century and a half, that when the government passes a law, Even putting aside the question of the binding nature of the law simply becomes the background and the law determines what the common practice is. Almost all of halacha says, certainly in contractual issues, people have the right to stipulate whatever terms they want. Even if they don't explicitly stipulate exactly what they want, the halacha is that we work with default assumptions. The prevailing practice, the general business custom, will be assumed to be incorporated into any contract they have which doesn't specify. So many poskim have argued that the law is not worse than any other custom. The law establishes the norms and the conventions under which business and other types of arrangements take place. Therefore, any business transaction entered into, even by two Jews, against the backdrop of a legal framework, will automatically be assumed to take place that the terms should be according to that legal framework. Going back to rent control, Ramosha Feinstein makes this point. He says that rent control will be binding upon two Jews, Jewish landlord, Jewish tenant, because when they signed their lease and they knew there was such a thing as rent control, then obviously their rental arrangement was meant to take place, and to incorporate any laws that govern the relations between landlords and tenants. I was in Yerushalayim once with some of my professional colleagues. We were watching various Batei Din operate. So I remember one evening I was at the home of Mendel Shafran, one of the most respected Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. He was doing quasi-formal arbitration just by himself and in his dining room table. A whole stream of people were coming in, going out. He was telling them what his opinion was on all manner of cases. He's a veteran. He's seen everything. He's done everything. I saw him pull a sefer off the shelf, I think, just once throughout the evening. The sefer he took out was something called Mishpat HaPoelim, a classic, modern, excellent work on the laws of labor, employment, management, and labor. What he pulled out the sefer for was not the halacha. He wasn't pulling out sefer halacha that night. What he was doing was, it was a question about pensions. Pensions in Israeli law are governed by law. The law, unlike in America, where it's a contractual issue between you and your employer, pensions in Israel are established by law. There was some question about a certain situation, about a pension. The Sefer Mishpat HaPoelim has a handy little appendix in the back where he publishes, for 50 pages or so, a synopsis of the major Israeli labor law. And he explains, even though we have halacha, we have Shulchan Aruch, but any contractual arrangements take place against the backdrop of the prevailing law. The law in this case is labor law. It's important for a dayan to know what the law is because the law will often be incorporated by default into any contract between two individuals, between an employer and an employee. We have to know what the law says, and we pass in halacha based on the law. So these are basically a number of different doctrines, aside from the basic rule of Chazal, Din Malchus Adina, that we accept the law of the land. These are a number of other arguments why today it goes much, much beyond that, much beyond the simple rule of Din Malchus Adina. Today we have democracies. Today the government provides services which benefit all the people. Today the taxes will be raised against people if you steal from the government. Today we don't have our own self-government. We have to defer to what the government says. So for all these reasons, various poskim in all these situations have ruled that Jews, even when doing business among themselves, certainly when doing business with the government or with non-Jews, with corporations, certainly will often be expected to follow the law of the land, in spite of the fact that Shulchan Aruch might sometimes not discuss a certain issue or might sometimes have different views. Very often we will be required to follow the law of the land and to conduct our business in accordance with prevailing business custom.
Thank you, Rabbi Grossman, and thank you, Rabbi Teitelbaum, for inviting me to participate in this program. I've done many programs of this nature where I talk about ethics, and I talk about legal issues, and I talk about Chilul Hashem and Kiddush Hashem. And I'll tell you an interesting story, which was a sort of a wake-up call for me. When I left the district attorney's office in 1980, I began to look for trial experience. And in 1980, the only people who were going to trial against the government were gangsters. When there was still organized crime, before they were all either killed or put in prison, these people went to trial. And if you wanted to learn my craft, you represented them, because most of the good lawyers were in those cases, and you learn how to cross-examine people, you learn how to deal with that government, and you really, that's how you honed your skill. And an FBI agent who liked me said, I want you to listen to this. It was a secret tape recording of a couple of gangsters, not knowing they're being recorded, talking about lawyers. And they were rating lawyers. And he said, listen to this. And they were naming people. And they said, I like that guy and that guy and that guy and that guy. And then the boss of the gangsters said, I like the Jew lawyer. And it was hard to understand. And I listened to it again. He said, I like the Jew lawyer. And then they went on to explain, and it was referring to me. And it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, I'm perceived by a name, but they all know that I'm Shomer Shabbos, and they all kid me because we have so many holidays, but I'm perceived as the Jew lawyer. And it occurred to me that I really had to do a good job. I had to be as good as I could be, but also as ethical as I could be, because if I wasn't, it wasn't just a bad mark against a lawyer. It was going to be a bad mark against the Jew lawyer. And people paint with a very broad brush, especially when it comes to our people. We don't get a fair shake. So we don't need any more sinah and we don't need any more embarrassment. We have enough without inviting more people to hate us. So I think we have an obligation, because now I've been doing this for almost 40 years, and I've gone through four decades of Jewish excuses, I call them. And early on, when you represented someone who was Shomer Shabbos, it was a shtetl Shoah excuse. My father had to bribe someone to get out of Germany. My father had to steal in order to eat. My father had to not pay taxes in order to survive. And my response is, you're not in a shtetl, you're in the United States of America, and as Rabbi Grossman said, we're not talking about bribing to survive. We're not talking about getting a passport so you can get out of a concentration camp and into a safe environment. You're in a safe environment. Then I found an uneducated excuse. We have, and it's starting now again in some respects, we have a whole community of young, very ethical, honest yeshiva boys and girls who never interact with the secular community. And they don't learn how to interact with the secular community. And then suddenly they're injected into the secular community. And I lectured in Lakewood in front of 1,000 people. And I said, you are not living in a shtetl. And when you think you're living in a shtetl, suddenly you get married, you have 5 kids, you need insurance, you need to buy a house, you need to go to the bank, you need to get a loan, you need to get life insurance and health insurance, and you don't get that in the shtetl. You go outside the shtetl, and you need to understand what the rules are. And then I encountered, I'm doing something bad, but I'm doing it for a good reason. And this was something that was often heartbreaking. I'm getting someone medical coverage that they're not entitled to because they have a pre-existing condition, and if I don't get the medical coverage, they're not going to get the medical treatment they need. So I'm going to lie on the application, and I'm going to get them the insurance because I'm saving a life, and it's pikuach nefesh. And instead, what happens is everybody involved in the process ends up getting immunity, testifies against the Rav who had this idea. The person who got the medical insurance is disallowed the coverage, and at the end of the year, it becomes a pogrom. There are so many people who end up being prosecuted. So the fact that you have a good motive or a good reason doesn't give you a legal defense. So you can't encourage that. But I want to make something very, very clear, because when I speak about this, people think, whoa, there must be a lot of criminals. Brafman represents a lot of frum criminals. I don't. You read about certain cases. You know about certain cases, because I sort of live in the public eye. But in the whole scheme of things, in the Orthodox community, we have, in my opinion, among the best people in the United States of America, and perhaps the entire world. We take care of our families. We take care of our communities. We take care of our elderly and the sick. We give tzedakah. We do good things. We take care of our children. We're good people. We're not bad people. The problem is that one person who is then viewed as a Jew reflects on the entire community sometimes. And it's a terrible situation. Nothing I'm going to say tonight reflects on any individual case, but this has been a rough week for me and Jews in particular. But I was in a courtroom in Trenton, New Jersey on Monday, and I heard maybe the most eloquent statement of charata, of I'm sorry, by a frum man in my entire career, and it so moved the judge, in my opinion, that regardless of what I said, she ended up giving a substantially lower sentence because of what he said. And it was a wonderful man who did a very bad thing for a good reason. And he has wonderful credentials. He has saved thousands of people, given homeless people homes, raised children, adopted families. An overwhelmingly good man. And he got up and he said to this judge the following, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. He said, Your Honor, all over the world, people are killing gay people in the name of religion. It's a desecration of God's name, because no God, whoever you pray to, wants you to kill someone in the name of religion, in his name. And I have violated the law and desecrated my religion. And I will carry that punishment with me for the rest of my life, regardless of the sentence you impose. That's the most severe punishment that I will carry for the rest of my life, knowing that my actions desecrated the Jewish religion and brought shame on the Jewish religion, and desecrated the name of God. And he sat down. And it was one of those moments, you know, you go through a career when I can pick out five, six moments in 40 years where everyone in the room knew something was very, very important that was said. And this was very, very important. The issues I deal with are terribly sad. The Rabbi Grossman talks about the halachic principles. I have an interesting practice. I can go from representing the head of a construction company to the head of a hospital, to the head of a real estate empire, to a gangster, to a rap star, and I see the entire universe of human action. And in every case, people say, how do you bridge all of those? How do you bridge all of those specialties? How do you know everything about construction and medicine and real estate and the rap world? I don't. I do know instinctively when something is right and when something is not right. And so do you. And so do the people who violate the law. When you do something which is inappropriate, it doesn't take experience as a criminal lawyer. It doesn't take being a Talmud Chacham. You know when you are crossing the line. And the difficulty is recognizing that it's a line that you're crossing and then having the guts to say, no, I'm not going to cross that line. So let me give you an example of the problems we're going to face in the next generation by good people, by honest people, by people who are grappling with issues that there may not be any legitimate answer to, but I think the Rabbanim in charge of all of these kolels are going to have to sit down one day and figure this out. Because right now in Lakewood, there are 10,000 young men sitting and learning. And they're learning Torah, Lishma, and they're all good, honest young men. 90% of them are living in illegal apartments. Many of them are on health plans that they don't belong to. People in many communities are living in Section 8 houses that they don't qualify for. And in order to suggest that they qualify, they have to have part of their income in paid in cash. And the employers who are enabling them to do that are just looking at a day in the future when it's going to be an unmitigated disaster, and it's going to turn out to be not just a Chilul Hashem, it's going to ruin lives. And you know, I'm active in the Israel Cancer Research Fund, and my wife's heard this story 50 times, so I apologize to her. But I gave an award to one of the leading oncologists in the world, and he got an award, and he's a brilliant man, and then he sat down next to me and he said, "You're Ben Braffman." And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "You have no idea how long I've wanted to meet you." And I said, "Why? Why?" He says, "Because we have so much in common." I said, "What do we have in common? You're an oncologist and I'm a criminal lawyer." He said, "No one's ever happy to meet me and no one's ever happy to meet you." And I said to him, "I'll tell you why that's an interesting observation, but I'll tell you why you're really not 100% right that we have a lot in common. When you lose, they die. When I lose, I get letters for 20 years. When you lose, they blame God and they come out and they hug you. When I lose, they blame me. And you operate in a dark room. No one sees what you're doing except your most trusted colleagues. I'm on a revolving world stage where everyone is second-guessing everything I do. And the worst part, doctor, you don't deal with humiliation. No one is humiliated when they get sick. No one is embarrassed in the community if they get cancer or if they have a heart attack. The family unit rallies to their support. Their friends become closer and stronger. Their children love them more. You do something that makes you a public pariah or embarrasses your family or your children or your machatanim or your shul or your community, and you're alone. I've talked more people out of committing suicide than most psychiatrists because the humiliation factor is devastating. It's much different than when you're sick." And he looked at me and he said, "You're right, we have nothing in common." So the issue is, you should not violate the law because it's the law. And if you're a frum person, and I'm not giving mussar, because I'm not a rav and I'm not qualified, my perspective is, you have no idea what pain you are asking for that's so different than anything you have ever understood or felt. The fear of having your future taken away from you while you're still alive is a very, very difficult concept to just try and understand unless you're sitting in that chair. It's the loneliest chair in the world when that happens. And the point I make when I speak to groups of honest citizens is, if you're raising your children to be erlich, then they need to be Erlich. They don't just need to be from. And it isn't a question of legality only. And it's something which, you know, I've raised before, and, you know, I have close friends here who share these views with me. If you're a frum kid and you're wearing a yarmulke and you got your tzitzis hanging out and you're running down Central Avenue and you're knocking people over, you're doing something that's not illegal, but it's a terrible thing to do. If you're sitting in a pizza store watching a mother with a double stroller try and get in the door and she can't, and you're just sitting there, every guy who works behind the counter who is either Hispanic or Puerto Rican or from Guatemala, watching you leave that woman to struggle while you're fressing, you're doing an avera. It's not against the law what you're doing, but it's ethical behavior that is just irresponsible, and that starts in the home. That starts in the home. You know, I wrote an article, and I will tell you, I must have gotten 500 emails. I went into Dunkin' Donuts on a Sunday morning to get donuts for my grandchildren, and there was one car just stopped in the middle. And a frum guy with a big yarmulke and tzitzis got out, and he helped his father out, and I gave him the benefit of the doubt, because that's what a criminal defense lawyer does. I assumed he was going to walk his father in, then get back in and park legally. He didn't. He got back in. The gridlock was in the parking lot. The parking lot is an insane asylum when everyone's parked legally in the Dunkin' Donuts on Rockaway Turnpike. And he left his car. And he went in, and he's waiting online. And I watched this. I was stunned, and I'm not shy. So I walked up to him, and he said, "Excuse me, you can't leave your car there." He looked at me, and he said, "I'm only going to be a minute." I said, "Nobody can come in this store for a minute on Sunday morning. It takes 15 minutes to get your food and get out. Look what's happening out there. This is a Chil Hashem." And I embarrassed him. And I wrote an article about it. I didn't use his name. I knew who he was. I didn't use his name. I got 500 emails thanking me for saying something that they had often thought and often wanted to say, but didn't say it. Is he a bad guy? No. He actually wrote me a very nice letter, apologizing, telling me he'd never done it before, he'll never do it again. And he wrote me a nice letter. Now I know who he is, for sure. But he really wrote me a very nice letter. It was the appropriate thing to do. So I made an impression. But we have young men and women who are growing up and they are not interacting with the secular world because we are seeking to protect them. And I get it. I understand it up to a point. But what we can't do is ignore the fact that they are interacting with a secular world. And what I do in my professional life all day long is I interact with the secular world. But I'm a Jewish person, and because I'm someone who is in the newspapers from time to time, because I'm someone who people recognize from time to time, I'm uncomfortable if I'm acting in the public arena in a way that I think I would be embarrassed if I saw another person I knew to be Jewish to be act that way. So I'm not here to tell you that Jews are criminals. They're not criminals. I think Jews are smart, and that's a blessing and it's a curse. You know, if you go into a Beis Medrash, all you hear is screaming. I hear screaming. I hear arguing. And the arguing is good because it brings out the other side of an issue that you might not otherwise understand. And that's really what limited exposure I had to Gemara. I get it. And it's helped me become a very good lawyer because I can see the other side of an issue. But what I also see, unfortunately, is it has trained certain minds to think that they are smarter than the people who go through life with the Gaiusha cup. And you know what? There are people who go through life with the Gaiusha cup. And I think part of my professional success, quite frankly, is because I don't have a Gaiusha cup. But that doesn't mean that you're smarter than the people who administer the programs that Rabbi Grossman talked about. And my practice is 5% of my practice from time to time deals with the Orthodox community. I would be very, very happy if I never had another frum client the rest of my life. But every time I do, inevitably, it's not someone who's a bad person. To the contrary, more often than not, it's someone who is too clever. Just too clever until they run up against someone who was more clever. And then suddenly you're not so clever. My mother, Allah Shalom, used to say, you're de bistanar. You're smart, you're not so smart. And when you try and be too smart in the legal world, the ramifications are horrific. And that's something you need to take home and explain to your children. You want to drive? Great. You want to drive when you're drunk? You're going to kill somebody, you're going to go to prison. You're going to kill somebody, you're going to live with that the rest of your life. You want to text something offensively to somebody else, it's going to be there forever. If you want to talk about reading a shidduch, forget about reading a shidduch. You want to be a judge, it's going to be there forever. You want to run for office, it's going to be there forever. People are worried about texting and driving, I'm worried about texting. Our kids talk without talking. I think it was the Rambam who said, if you talk, think twice. Think. If you write something, think twice. When you text, when you hit the send button, I can't tell you how many lives have been ruined that I'm aware of. Young kids, infantile, teenage transgressions that used to be you call somebody a name, they forgot. You send it, and it's forever. You take a picture that's inappropriate, it's forever. There are computer experts that I deal with. You could take your computer, you could smash it and throw it in the ocean. I can restore all of your emails. So we have to teach our children to be erlich, but being erlich doesn't mean daven Shmona Esrei for a long time. Being erlich doesn't mean looking down on someone who is not as frum as you are. And today, we live in a regulated society. And so I'm going to end with this. The society we live in today is so regulated that it is almost impossible not to violate a rule if you act recklessly. So you hire the right people to show you and help you. You don't just wing it. And the other thing that is extraordinary today that people don't understand is if you are charged today with a fraud, a significant fraud, you will go to jail for a longer period of time than if you went out tomorrow and shot somebody in the event that they didn't die. So when I grew up in this business, no one went to jail for nonviolent offense the first time. Very few people went to jail, nonviolent offense, second time. You have to be viewed as a danger to the community. Today, the issue is deterrence. We're sending you to jail so that someone else won't do what you just did. So I don't want from people to have this terrible, terrible experience. But part of the reason they have it, in my opinion, is not because we're bad, we're not, we're good. We're not wholesale bad, that's for sure. We're wholesale good. But everything we do, everything any of you do who walk in the street with the yarmulke on, I think reflects on all of us. So this is not a mussar speech. I said to the rabbi, Rabbi, you know, I'm a criminal lawyer. I get to speak on ethics, legal ethics and Jewish ethics. They're really the same issue. There is no distinction between what's halakhically legally correct and what is legally correct. If it's not in accordance with the law, it's not halakhically correct. We're not talking about whether you can move the potato kugel off the stove on Shabbos because there's oil in the pan. We're not talking about something that you can spend 2 hours discussing in terms of what is halakhically correct. What's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong. And rarely do you need someone like me to tell you that it's wrong. I spoke in Borough Park with 2,000 people there in a program like this. And when it was over, I got one question from a young boy in a beard and payas. I'll never forget this as long as I live. Can I ask you a question, Mr. Brockman? He said, yes. He said, is it wrong to have 2 Social Security cards? I said, no, it's great. You should be very proud of it. You should tell your rebbeim, and you should tell your parents, and you should tell everybody. How could you ask that question? And you know what I realized? I realized that there is a world out there that is our Jungleid, we call them, who are not being exposed to the law of the land that Rabbi Grossman tells you they're supposed to abide by. And I think the next generation needs to step up and do something about it. I've spoken to Rav Aaron Kotler, who's very much in favor of trying to extend some secular teachings into the Torah program, because these kids are getting married at 20, and by 25 they have 4 children. And then if their father dies or their father-in-law dies, they need to have parnassah, and they're not trained for anything other than chinuch. And even in chinuch, not everybody is cut out to be a rav or a rebbe. And suddenly they have a job. And they don't know how to interact with their co-workers. Suddenly they're in a room with not just boys in the yeshiva, but they have co-workers, and they say things that are inappropriate, or they act inappropriately, and it creates a Chilul Hashem. So I'm going to tell you one Chilul Hashem, Kiddush Hashem story, not because it was my son, but because it really shows you how easy or hard it is to to do something right or wrong instantly. I took my son is a Rosh Kollel in Eretz Yisrael. Most of you know him. He's a very good boy. He came to New York, and he was leaving Sunday night. And when we grew up together, before he became a Rosh Kollel, we used to go to the ball games together. I said, David, go with me one day to the... You're going home tonight. Go with me. So we went, because Kibbutz Av Eim is high on his list. So we went. And I was in a t-shirt and a baseball hat, and he was in black pants and a white shirt, and his sitzes were out, and he had a big black yarmulke. And we were sitting in very good seats, and a foul ball came. I've been going to the games for 45, 50 years. I've never had a foul ball. Suddenly a foul ball is coming right towards him, and he catches the ball. And standing right below him is a white Irish kid with red hair, I'll never forget it, with a baseball glove. And he has the saddest look I've ever seen on a kid's face, because he thought he was getting this ball. And my son was bigger, and my son reached out and got it. And my son looked down at him and gave him the ball. Got a standing ovation from Citi Field. It was on the big screen. People were applauding, screaming, yelling that the Jew gave the kid the ball. Now I said to him, David, you could sit in Eretz Yisrael for the rest of your life. You will never make a bigger Kiddush Hashem than you just made. And I'll tell you something else. If you hadn't given them the ball, tomorrow, at every worker who was at this game would say, that Jew bastard took the ball from the little kid. And instead, they're going to say, Jewish guy caught a ball. It's a big deal to catch a foul ball for America. A Jewish guy caught a ball and he gave it to a little guy. So when you're wearing a yarmulke, you catch a foul ball at a game, look for some guy to give it to. Okay.
Just a little brief follow-up to some of Mr. Braffman's points. Thank you. I like that. Just to follow up to a few of his points. The idea that even when one Jew does something, he's not simply damaging his own image in the eyes of the world, he's damaging the entire Jewish community. This has strong precedence in the halakhic literature, too. In the medieval period, they discussed the case of the counterfeiter. Counterfeiting was a really big deal then, much more than it is now. It was, I think, a capital crime, and there was collective punishment, too. If they caught you, they would do who knows what to the rest of the Jewish community. So the post can say, if we, the Jewish community, find someone in our midst who's counterfeiting, we simply turn him into the government. Say, we have nothing to do with this. Take him. You know, he's endangering the whole community. He's a menace to society, and we just turn him in because he's endangering all of us. And in general, the idea of Chilul Hashem that he mentioned also, the idea that if you do something in public, even if it's not prohibited, it's not an Avera, it's not illegal, nevertheless, you're doing a Chilul Hashem, the Gemara itself has examples of that. The Gemara points out that it depends on your position too. If you're a student of Torah, if you're a Jew, if you somehow represent Judaism, if you represent Torah, then certainly you have a responsibility not to do things, even things which are perfectly technically legitimate. The Gemara gives an example. Various Amoraim said, if I take merchandise on credit and don't pay for it immediately, it's legal, but it's looked at as cheap, it's looked at as taking advantage, so that's us, or that's the Chilul Hashem. So certainly, we all have responsibilities to avoid doing anything. It's fair, it's not fair, you know, we argue we shouldn't be representatives of the whole Jewish community. The fact is we are, and the fact is we certainly have a responsibility to avoid making Chilul Hashem of that sort. I wanted to speak for a minute or two about the attitude we have toward the criminal justice system. I spoke before mostly on civil issues, just to speak a little bit about the criminal justice system. The Gemara has an interesting little story. It says there was a Tana figure named Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon. He was apparently the Sherlock Holmes of the Talmud. He could tell that Holmes could look at your cigarette, your cigar ash, or your pants cuff and give you the entire itinerary of your morning. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon could do that. He could, if he saw you nodding off in a bar, he would deduce that you were living a secret life of crime at night. And you know, the Gemara's example might not be all that persuasive, but in general, he's apparently very good at what he did. The government drafted him to catch thieves. He would catch them using his methods of deduction, and the government would, of course, execute them, as was the custom back then. Some of his rabbinic colleagues were not so happy with his chosen... Well, he wasn't chosen, he was drafted, but with his profession. They said, what are you doing? You're killing Jews. He said, they deserve it. Kotzimani machalim and akarim, they're thorns, they deserve to be destroyed. They said, no, let God worry about the thorns, you shouldn't be doing this. So this is an Agadat Gemara. It doesn't have any obvious halachic conclusion. Nevertheless, the poskim do understand that he actually was correct. It is permitted for a Jew to be hired, but to aid the criminal justice system in catching and punishing felons, even though the due process halacha normally has, we learn in Gemara, we learn about witnesses and warnings and all that, the government is allowed to have criminal justice that doesn't have our sense of due process. The government is allowed to have much more draconian penalties than we have. They can execute thieves. All that is legitimate. It is the purview of the government. It's right, it's privilege, it's prerogative, it's duty to enforce justice, and we support that. That in Hormona de Malka, if we act as their agent, if a Jew acts as the government's agent, that is fine. According to many poskim, that is a legitimate activity. What the government's doing is legitimate. We supporting them is a legitimate act. And many poskim have invoked this. Shevet Levi, Rav Ozner says, a Jew is permitted to be a tax auditor of some sort because, again, the government has the right to levy taxes, the government has the right to enforce collection of taxes, the government has the right to penalize, to criminalize lack of payment of taxes, and therefore, it's permitted for the government, it's permitted for the deputies of the government. There are even a couple of tshuvas about desecrating graves. We know that we're always very unwilling to disturb the sanctity of a grave, to disinter a corpse. Autopsies, we always do whatever we can to avoid it. There are a handful of tshuvas about the need for autopsies in the case of murder. Divrei Malkiel or Malkiel Tenenbaum talks about a case where the Jews were considering filing a complaint, a criminal complaint, opening an investigation about a murder. The problem was they knew the government would disinter the body to do a forensic autopsy. Divrei Malkiel says, no problem, we should do it anyway. It's worth it, he says. The deceased himself would be okay with it. He wants his murderer caught. It's good for his soul. Like in the ghost stories, it's good for his soul to have his murderer brought to justice. He wants it. It's good for the community. We have to maintain deterrence. We have to deter crime. And again, I'll just close with Rabbi Leo Kalatskin again. He complains bitterly. He says, very often, he says, relatives do whatever they can to block autopsies, to obstruct justice, to interfere with criminal justice. It's absolutely wrong, he says. It's against halacha. The victim, he said, the murdered man, he needs justice. It's appropriate for him to get justice. We Jews should be supporting that, he says. We should not be obstructing the criminal justice systems. We should be supporting it. The relatives have a misguided concern for the sanctity of the grave, he said, but on the contrary, it's not worth this kind of obstruction of justice. So again, everything has its rules. That doesn't mean we should always be reporting any infraction we see in any event to the government, but the appropriate attitude is the government's criminal justice system. It's their job. They're supposed to be doing it. We agree with it. We endorse it. And according to many poskim, we're even allowed to participate, at least when deputized by the government, we're allowed to participate, even if it means catching Jews, even if it means punishing Jews. The job of the government is to enforce law and order, to criminal law and order. That's a legitimate course of action, both for the government and for Jews who are in its service.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Grossman and Mr. Brock. If there are any questions, but not statements, please, let's make sure that we're asking questions out of either of our panelists, either Rabbi Grossman or Ben Brock. Thank you. Yes?
Yes, I have a question for Rabbi Grossman.
Could you just stand up
yes,
and speak
I
also?
I have a question for Rabbi Grossman, but I suppose either one could answer it. It's true in terms of the enforcement of laws and what the Jew's responsibility should be. But there's also the issue of Mesira, on the other hand. And I think part of the difficulty in our community is finding a balance between the two. Could you address that?
Yes, so that's absolutely correct. And there is, and I meant to allude to that, there is a very longstanding aversion, abhorrence even, of Mesira, of reporting on Jews to the government. However, the point I was trying to make was that in a case where you're dealing with a legitimate government, a just government, a government that has due process. Now, again, you can always point to cases where the system fails, where something goes terribly awry. No one's going to argue no system is perfect, no system of laws and of men is going to be perfect. But many posts can recognize that insofar as we're dealing with a just, not all necessarily, but insofar as we're dealing with a just government, and the need to protect the community will override Monsieur. Not always, and I'm not going to say a blanket rule, I'm not going to discuss specific cases, but with regard, let's say, to cases of abuse, then there was a whole symposium about this a number of years ago, published in the Israeli journal Yeshurun, where a number of leading Haredi poskim, we're not even talking about progressive, a number of hardline Israeli poskim said, they mentioned the Gemara I mentioned, that criminal justice is the job of the government and it's important to protect society. And they said, we see from the Gemara that we're allowed to cooperate with them and it's necessary to protect the community. In many cases, it will be allowed. There's a tshuva in the Maram Shik. He was asked about a murder. A woman was believed to have murdered her husband. The question is, should they set the wheels of justice in motion to convict her? And he says, yes, they're allowed to, he says. Same Gemara, that the government punishing murder and deterring crime is its job. And he says that the lesson of the Gemara is that the rabbis maybe should stay out of it. It is a dirty business, that the rabbi should stay above it. It's not their job. But in general, he says that the community is not wrong for cooperating. Now you're right. There is a prohibition of Masira, and it's a very serious prohibition. There are dire things said about it in the Poskim. And exactly what the balance is something difficult to discuss in a forum like this. But I was just emphasizing that people sometimes jump to the notion of Masira right away. It's not that simple. There is another side.
Let me respond from a legal standpoint. We're not dealing with shtetl where it's a question of are there Jews in the attic, and where you're afraid that if you say yes to the government official, they're going to go off and they're going to shoot them. Today in the United States of America, Masira is not a legal defense to enforcement of a subpoena. And if you are subpoenaed, then you say, I don't want to testify because it's against another Jew. That's been tested. It's been ruled against us over and over and over again. And now there are people sitting in jail as we speak on contempt orders because they won't testify against another Jew. And the courts don't accept that as a defense. And to be perfectly honest with you, I've been to half of the Rosh Yeshiva in New York for certain on trying to get someone a heter so that their life isn't ruined when they're put in a position where they have no choice but to testify. And in many cases, the Rabbanim look for a halachic way to allow them to do it. And there's always some tension between Dina de Machos Adina and the law of the land. The law of the land is the law of the land. It's not the law of halacha, it's the law of the land. The law of the land says, you're a Jew, you could be subpoenaed and forced to testify against another Jew, and if you don't like it, then you suffer the consequences.
How as an attorney, do you overcome that reluctance in communities that you address? If the civic communities that are very much lean towards the other side, lean towards the issue of Masira rather than the issue of the individual.
I think you have to distinguish between informing on someone because you just don't like what they're doing and you want to cause them harm, and responding to a lawful inquiry from a government official. I'm not dealing with someone who decides, I'm going to go turn in Yankel because I think Yankel's a ganef. That's a whole separate issue that you can deal with the Rabbanim about. I'm talking about in a Hasidic community, time and again, people are given a subpoena. Their choice is to show up and testify or show up and say it's against my Jewish religion. And I will tell you that any federal judge in the United States today who you are brought before on this issue will not respect your religious conviction. And you could very well end up in jail if you persist. Now, I've dealt with it 1,500 times over the last 40 years, and I tried to explain it, and you're right. There are some people who are resolute in their insistence that they will not testify. There is a shamus who was prosecuted in connection with an Orthodox charity out in Los Angeles. He was given an opportunity to cooperate, refused to cooperate, pled guilty, got 28 months in jail, finished his sentence, then was subpoenaed to testify against another rub. And he said, I'm not going to testify. They gave him another 18 months. Now, ultimately, the law of contempt expires if it's clear that they're never going to be able to get the person to comply. But that's 4 years he spent in jail on the principle of Masira. You know how many people like that I've met in my life? One.
I would just add to that those are the facts, but that doesn't necessarily speak to right and wrong. We do have journalists who sit in jail and sit in jail proudly because it's their journalistic ethics that they will not reveal the source. There may be cases where halacha requires you to sit in jail. It's unfortunate, but Masira is a real thing. You may sometimes have to go to jail. Not always, but there is a tension we can't discuss exactly.
I think the difficulty for Rob is trying to find that balance and to reach a community, and I think that's really the role both of the criminal attorney and the rug to try to find that balance and explain that to a community. And that would be a great service if that could be defined more clearly.
Thank you. Anybody else? Any questions?
I had one before.
Yes.
You were talking before in a community in the old days when they put the theft, they would kill the person. You were saying that they allowed someone to work for the government where a theft would result in his execution. Does that really make sense in the sense that nowhere in halakha would you ever be in a situation where you'd be killed for theft, and you're working for a government that would kill somebody?
I agree. It's a remarkable conclusion, but it is pretty clearly the conclusion of the Gemara and of some of the commentators. It is surprising, but the idea seems to be that governments have the right to set their own levels of punishment for crime. Those punishments might be more or less than the Torah, and you know, not the governments have the commandment of dinim to establish courts, to establish justice. The punishments may be much more draconian than ours. You're right. It's a remarkable thing, but that does indeed seem to be the conclusion of some authorities.
You're chayav misa for a lot of stuff. As I remember, that in a secular court, you wouldn't get the death penalty for, right? So it's, you know, there's a difficult balance. And, you know, when you talk about halacha and you talk about things that were written 5,000-6,000 years ago, it's in a different time. And there are societies today where if you steal, they'll chop off your hand. Now, they're not as civilized as we are, but they have less thieves than we do. So.
That's less clear. Yes, you are observing correctly. I did note that he was drafted. He did not volunteer for it. It says the government saw how good he was. They pressed him into service. It is less clear that he would have been allowed to volunteer for that. That's something which is more ambiguous. The tshuva of the Maram Shik I quoted, the communities, it seems, they wanted to actually open a criminal complaint with the government in Europe somewhere, in Hungary, and he allowed that. He seems to imply that citizens themselves can take the initiative and do that. But that's a matter of some dispute. It's less clear.
Gentlemen, just sort of a related follow-up question to the earlier two questions. If somebody has been indicted, let's say insider trading cases, they're usually trying to go up the ladder to the higher-ups, and they offer the individual to wear wiretap, to wear wires, and sort of to save his own skin, would that be allowed in Halakha, or does he just have to suffer
consequences of what he's done so far, these are very personal decisions and they're fact-specific cases. And let me give you a bit of a news break. Most cases are not solved by the United States government. Most cases are handed to them on a silver platter by people who panic the minute an FBI agent shows them his or her credentials, and they immediately agree to cooperate, and then the case is solved. So at the end of the day, if people did not agree to testify against other people, I think the law enforcement machine would grind to a halt. But there are incentives for people to cooperate that are very, very powerful. You know, you can not go to jail for 20 years if you cooperate. There are whistleblowers who get $100 million for cooperating against an entire industry, and very rarely do those present halachic issues to the people I've seen who have had to deal with it. And in a few cases where it was someone who cared about the halachic implications, they've often gone to a rav, and sometimes depends on which rav you go to. Well, I don't think anyone has ever created a ethics curriculum or I call it a Menschlichkeit curriculum. There are some issues that I think have to be developed in the home. Parents have to raise their kids to be basically informed on Menschlich interaction, not just with their siblings and their neighbors, but with the outside world. But the one thing that I would encourage, and I don't want to get hate mail for this, but I would encourage that if someone is going to be graduating high school today and live in the United States of America, if they are not proficient in basic English and reading and math, then there is a failure to prepare them for the world. They don't have to know trigonometry and they don't have to know world geography, but they can't walk into a bank and apply for a mortgage for their home and fill out an application completely incorrectly because they haven't been trained and they haven't had anybody show them what box to check. You know, if you make a mistake on an application for a mortgage, it's a mistake. If you lie on a mortgage application, you can go to jail for 10 years because it's bank fraud. So if I were running Lakewood, and I'm not looking to run Lakewood, but if I were running Lakewood, I would say to the Rabbanim, look, I'm not looking to make these kids less frum, and I'm not looking to introduce them to the shtus of the world, and I don't want them to learn all of the bad stuff that they have available on the internet. But they are going to have to function pretty soon and interact with the secular world. Because you can grow up in the shtetl, you can learn in the shtetl, and you can remain in that environment only so long. And then eventually, you have to go to the hospital, you have to get health insurance, you have to get a mortgage, you have to drive a car, you have to buy insurance. You have to do things where the people on the other end of the transaction are not forgiving, they're not understanding, they expect you to know the basic rules. And I think that there are curriculum that can be developed that don't require rocket science and don't require billions of dollars of funding. It requires an interest in the institution recognizing the need, and then it requires getting the trained personnel to do it. But I think it's going to have to be done, because I think I've seen the problem when the uneducated try to interact with the technical world, and they can't all work in the diamond industry, and they can't all work at B&H Photo. Many of them are going to end up working in a real company and have to abide by real rules.
So is the solution more speeches from your clients as opposed
to... No. You don't need speeches from my clients. I mean, that speech was the exception. You don't need people to come in. This is not scared straight. Well, you know, you get an ex-con come to a group of yeshiva kids and say, you know, if you foul up and you go to prison, someone like me is going to rape you when you're in there. That's not what's needed. What we have is basically very, very good kids who are honest. I'm not talking about the dishonest chevreman who you have in every class. Maybe there's one or two. I was one once, I know. I'm not talking about that person. I'm talking about the good kids. The good kids who just don't know. They grew up in a family of 10, 12. They don't have access to their parents perhaps as much as they should. So they're part of a group of people who feed off of each other, and there's an ignorance there. It's not an insulting word, ignorance. It's an uneducated ignorance where I can survive for the next 60, 70, 80, maybe 120 years without ever having to learn how to interact with the secular community. And it's not that way anymore. And it can't be the future. We're going to have very, very serious issues. You know, people talk about the tuition crisis, and people are not sending their kids to yeshiva because they can't afford to send them to yeshiva. That's issue, big issue for the Orthodox community. And a lot of people smarter than I am and more successful than I am are focusing on that full time. How are we going to keep families to be able to send their kids to school when tuition is $25,000 a year or more in yeshivas? How are we going to do that? That's issue number one. Second, what are we going to do with all these people? You have 10,000 people learning in Lakewood now. They're each going to end up, please God, with 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 children apiece. And by the time they're 40, they're going to be grandparents. And what are they going to teach? What are they going to do? And what's going to happen when my generation dies? Soon.
Ben, you gave a few examples of what I would call Lo'olein, a Chilul Hashem waiting to happen. How do you, the Section 8 stuff, the health care, how do you walk that back? What's the answer?
For some of these, there are no answers. Because the problem is too big, and it would require something like the Gruss Foundation to suddenly give somebody $1 billion to undo that damage. So I'm not talking about walking back the existing problem. I'm trying to prevent that problem from manifesting itself again as a cancer 20, 30 years down the road. I don't think you can walk it back, but because we're now aware of it, I'm going to tell you something which when I heard, I was stunned. There was a period of time, and I give Rabbi Cutler the credit for stopping it. There was a period of time when young women would be showing up in Lakewood hospitals about to give birth and try and get the benefits of being a single mother. Because they've only been married by a rav, they never had a license, so they were never legally registered as having been married anywhere. And they would show up pregnant, and they would be treated as single mothers, and they would get single mother benefits, and they'd be in the room with their husband and their three other children. And everyone in the hospital knew what was going on, and yet they did it. And when I was speaking at a program with someone mentioned it, I walked over to him and I said, "You know about this?" He says, "It's being stopped." And he stopped it. But who would even think that you would have the chutzpah to try and do that? And yet it was a chop. You know what a chop is? That's part of the problem with our community. We know the chops.
Saying my husband's going to kill me, my husband's going to kill me. You probably know I'm talking about. And he allegedly did kill her, and with two kids. And the parents refused to do an autopsy because of Jewish law. I have to know the detectives on the case from another matter, and they said because she was in the ground so long, you can't get DNA. So he's getting away with it right now. And I'm just wondering, how does the law of autopsy, of the Jewish law, how does that...
It's very rare today that if there is a body that's recovered where there are serious signs that this is not a natural death, that the family will be allowed to bury the body immediately. They are familiar with the procedure now. In that case, and I know the case you're talking about goes, well, in the newspapers, I'm not involved in the case, there were no signs of trauma. There was no evidence at the beginning. There was rumor. There was accusation. But today... if a body is recovered and the body has trauma, which shows that the person was the victim of a homicide, you're not getting that person released for burial immediately. There's going to be a medical examiner that's going to be called there. It's going to be done very quickly. Rabbi Teitelbaum must know. Shaking his head, he knows cases like that. Rabbi Hain knows cases like that. I'm called on, and sometimes I'm fighting with the parents who want to bury the child. And I said, you need to find out who did this to your child. So it's an interesting question, but you know what's happened is there's been a progression of the government and religion figuring each other out. And you have to understand that the American criminal justice system is not perfect, but they now get it, and they're getting it better and better. And you know, Judge Feller is sitting here. I mean, you know, and he was in court for many years. When I used to come into court 35 years ago, and I used to say, Judge, if we're going to do this trial now, on Fridays, I'm going to have to leave at 2 o'clock. And I would get pushback. And they would say, we don't leave at 2 o'clock on Friday. Today, there's no pushback. And it's not because I'm Ben Brackman or they know me. Today, they get it. They understand. It's a process of education. The issues with autopsy, it evolved. But detectives were afraid to fight with the rabbis 35, 40 years ago. They thought they were committing a serious crime, a sin.
Here, too, they were afraid to fight with it. The community said, leave it alone. The parents said, don't.
Yes, but then the police say, look, you know, this is the family and this is what they want to do. But today it doesn't work that way. I've been in 20 cases where the autopsies were delayed, where they were delayed for reasons because they needed to do testing. And I've been in cases where from people were dug up after 20 years, which is a big, you know, one of the big errors of all time to you know, disturb the mace. And yet when the DNA testing was more specific and more expertly done nowadays, the testing has led to the solving of a lot of crime. And Rabbi Grossman, you know, said, I think the victim has a right for justice as well.
The halacha has precedent that way, as Rabbi Grossman said, and there's recently been psak for the investigation of cause of death when it's certainly medically advised for the siblings to know what caused the death of their brother or sister so that they can be warned, so that they can take precautions in their personal life. There have been posts that have allowed that there be autopsy for the sake of siblings' health. That's how far they might be able to allow autopsy when there's a particular disease that might have to be known so that others can be protected, as an example. So the halacha is quite, I don't want to say lenient, that would be perhaps an overstatement, but the halacha really does allow for the autopsy that you might discuss when there's any evidence or grounds for the suspicion of foul play. No question. When there is the possibility of helping others, especially family members, not a question any longer either.
So that means it was a parent's choice not to seek this protector to...
I don't know the case you're referring to. I'm saying halakhically, there are times when you may have an autopsy of an individual A, for the sake of knowing what the cause of death was, so that you might preclude harm or illness or death for individuals B, C, and D.
And sometimes the family doesn't get to make the decision. Children are taken away from parents for when it's determined that it's in the best interest of the child all the time, and the parents don't agree to it. You know, the law is pretty tough when it wants to be tough.
We have time for one last question.
So, the question above as a criminal defense attorney, obviously people tell you things that you can never tell anyone else because of the confidentiality. As a rabbi, you understand that there are certain halachas such as Al Tamar V'Damarecha. How do you balance it to them?
I'm not a rabbi.
I know. Yes, you both balance it.
So there is actually halakhic literature on this question. There are responses from contemporary poskim. Again, I always point out, the cases they discussed are very one-sided. They're kind of easy ones, so to speak. You know, hard cases make bad law, but the cases they get asked were the easy ones, like, you know that the Rav Waldenberg in Israel, Rav Yosef, they have questions like, you're a doctor, your patient is an epileptic, and he's driving, and he's not reporting his condition, and he's in danger of having a seizure and killing people on the road. They say, Rav Waldenberg says, confidentiality, too bad. You can't allow the risk of a fatal accident to override the concern. That has to override the concern for confidentiality. They discuss other cases. There's a case of Rav Reich in Switzerland. He talks about a case where somebody was getting married and hadn't disclosed to his spouse that he had terminal cancer and wasn't being given more than a year or two to live. He says such a problem with a marriage, such an obvious failure to disclose, is something, if you know, even if it was told to you in confidence, you have to save the other party to the marriage. Those are pretty kind of one-sided cases. In the real world, there's going to be a lot more gray. So it's going to be impossible to give general rules that will cover all these cases. But yeah, the balancing, like we discussed before, the balancing of the values is what the working post-six job is. But the point is, yes, halakha does recognize that at some point we will have to override confidentiality for the good of the public.
So does the law. I mean, as you well know, Saul, your attorney-client privilege is not absolute. Someone walks into my office and tells me they killed someone, I'm not allowed to disclose that to the authorities. But if someone comes into my office and says, tomorrow I'm going to shoot someone, I have a right to stop that person and to inform against it, because it's a future crime, which is not privileged. So it's nothing is absolute. I have Rabbanim coming to me who are asking me, Shilas, of what their legal obligation is when clients come to them and confide in them what is clearly criminal behavior involving either a spouse or a spouse against a child. And I say, you know, I'm not giving you the halachic issue, but I will take you to the district attorney's office and have that parent removed from the home because he's a threat to the child. And I think that's what you need to understand. And it's fact specific, so you can't give a general answer.
I want to answer one part of your question, if I may, and that is that when you so much as know that, let's call him Reuven, is in discussions with Shimon about a potential business deal that they will do together, and you know factually that Shimon has taken other people's money illegally, unethically, you are not only allowed to warn Reuven, you are obligated to say to Reuven, this person with whom you're about to do a deal has once done X, Y. You have to know factually. It can't be something that you heard. It has to be a fact. But once you know factually that Shimon has been dishonest in the past, you are obligated to tell Reuven.
Can that override its attorney client?
And a rabbi, that I can't answer.
Okay.
But as a rov, I can tell you for sure.
Okay.
Obligation that you say, that's lo samo al dam reacha. One of the interpretations of dam is dummy, meaning money, not just blood, but money as well. Thank you very much, everybody. And thank you again, Rabbi Grossman and Mr. Rabbi.